This is Christian Robillard, and you're listening to Beyond the Bake Sale, where we help you raise more time, talent, and treasure in innovative, creative, and effective ways for the causes you care about. On this episode, I sat down with David Tinker. Dave is Vice President of Advancement at Achieva, a nonprofit parent organization that has comprehensive services and supports and serves thousands of people with disabilities and their families each year. He is also an adjunct professor of informatics in Muskingum University's Master of Information Strategy, Systems, and Technology program. An AFP Master Trainer, he received the Outstanding Fundraising Executive Award from the AFP Western Pennsylvania chapter in 2013. In 2017, Dave was honored as part of the inaugural class of Distinguished Fellows of AFP International. Dave received a Master of Public Affairs with a concentration in nonprofit management from the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. He received a Bachelor of Arts in Chemistry and English and a Master of Information Strategy, Systems, and Technology from Muskingum University. He is also a graduate of Leadership Works, Indianapolis, Class 3. In our conversation, we discussed what Sunday school can teach you about fundraising, love like the boys, and why more meetings aren't always a bad thing. So I hope you enjoy this episode. Dave, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Absolutely. I'm so grateful that our mutual friend, Leah Eustace, was able to connect us and talk about such a timely topic. And I thank you for making the time for our audience and also for your service to the Association of Fundraising Professionals. I understand you've done quite a bit of work with them and have been a distinguished fellow with AFP. So really grateful for all that you've contributed towards our profession and all the knowledge you're about to download onto us around fundraising in a crisis situation. So really grateful for that. Wanted to chat with you first, Dave, to I guess, start off our conversation. We always like to ask our guests on the show because we feel that there are some heroic stories behind all of the individuals that we have a chance to pick their brain about and have conversations with. Was wondering if you can reflect back on, you know, your 30-year plus career as a fundraiser as of now, plus all of that pre-story, that pre-roll, if you would, if you're thinking about it in a bit of a superhero comic book context. If you were to, I guess, flag out between, let's say, 5 comic book panels and like 12 of what your origin story of coming from where you were, you know, whether it's as a child or as a kid, all the way up to present day, are there a set of 5 to 12 panels that really jump out for you as kind of some of those defining moments?
Yeah, I'm a bit unusual. I would say it might start, you know, being a young child going to Sunday school. Going to church every Sunday, my Sunday school teacher and my youth group leader actually happened to be the CEO of a big fundraising council. And because of that, you know, our families were very close. I went to a small church, so everybody knew everyone. And it was actually a church, even though we had maybe 120 members, I would think a dozen or so were actually in the fundraising profession. By chance and by because of Bob, the CEO, because he was very good at trying to recruit people who had good emotional IQ to get into fundraising back before that was a thing, emotional IQ. But yeah, so my first panel and second panel would probably be, you know, Sunday school with him and his wife, and then youth group growing up with them as well and doing a lot of community activities. And to me, that was normal. That's just what you did. It wasn't, you know, necessarily fundraising as a profession. But then, you know, forward to another panel where, yeah, I'm a freshman in college. I knew dead on I was going into medical school because that's what I wanted to do. I still have a degree in chemistry. That didn't change. But I loved the summer internship I had at Ketchum running that first summer so much that I kept asking to come back. So for 3 summers, I worked at Ketchum Fundraising Council here in Pittsburgh, where the headquarters was, and I got to meet a large number of people who many are still actively involved or getting close to, you know, more towards retirement age. I hate to say that, but I got to meet a lot of people that way. Through that, I got a lot of connections. And, you know, the next panel, you know, I'm at the beach and I'm talking to Bob because our family's actually also vacation together. And, you know, talk to him about, okay, I don't want to go to medical school anymore necessarily. I want to go to graduate program for fundraising. And at the time, there was only a handful of schools to choose from, and this was in the early 1990s. And he recommended what is now the Lilly Family School of Philanthropy at Indiana University. At the time, it was just a center on philanthropy. And I got to, I ended up going there. I applied. It was actually the only place I applied for grad school, but I got in, which looking back, I probably should have applied to a couple more places. But, you know, I didn't know any better at the time, I guess. But I did get in. I had a fantastic education while I was there. I got to meet tons of people, many of whom I'm still friends with today, including a woman who's my mentor. And she, you know, you go forward, I got to work in city government for a year doing fundraising while I was there. And then I got to work for a big national association where a woman who's now, I still consider my mentor, I got to work with her. And she's still such a big part of my life. Actually, one of my daughters is named after her.
Oh, wow.
Of all things. But yeah, it's, you know, I loved fundraising. That really felt like I found my niche. You know, it was my calling. And I stayed there. And so another panel, you know, once I graduated from what is now Lilly School of Philanthropy, I stayed in Indianapolis and worked for a large hospital system fundraising, doing annual giving special events. And I loved it. But I wanted to come back to Western Pennsylvania, where I'm from, and spend, you know, do some more work here and spend some time a little bit closer to family, but getting involved with organizations I knew growing up. So I spent time working in disabilities, nonprofits here, and education nonprofits here, as well as volunteering on several professional associations. I've been with Achieva now for 15 years, and you know, I love being here. It's a great organization. It's an easy cause to raise money for, in my opinion, because they do such outstanding work with everybody that we support.
Reflecting back on your time both at Sunday school and having conversations with your mentor on an active basis and things of that nature, are there any particular lessons or words of wisdom or piece of advice that stand out for you as being really influential in how you conduct yourself or in having changed your career in one way, shape, or form?
Absolutely. There's a couple of things that have stood out. One was, remember, it's about the donor. It's not about necessarily the mission. It's what you want to try to connect the donor with their interests, and their, it might not be your own organization, but that's okay. Maybe you can connect them with an organization that's better suited to what their interests are, and that's okay to do, and it's the right thing to do. I think ethics in fundraising was instilled in me very early on without me realizing it. And I'm very thankful to both Bob Thompson, who was the CEO at Ketchum at the time, and then Lilia Wagner for that. Because it's been such a great experience. You know, even when you don't know what to do, you still know the ethical thing to do. And so you have something, whether it's the AFP Code of Ethics to rely on, or Grant Professional Association's Code of Ethics, or Land Giving Council, or CAGP, or whoever's Code of Ethics you're trying to follow. And yeah, just, you can't necessarily go wrong if you're being ethical in what you're doing.
And in most of the conversations we've had with Beyond the Bake Sale and many of our guests, they always revert back to, if they could teach anything or teach any fundraiser, anything or anyone, whatever important lesson that there is, that the ethical decision-making matrix paradigm, thought process, even just teaching people how to think about and interpret situations and not just here's the definitive right and here's the definitive wrong, is the one thing that stands out definitely for them.
And I think the other key thing too that they probably instilled in me is just, you know, taking time to listen to what the donor or potential donor has to say, because they have a lot to say and everybody's very happy to share their story. You just have to ask.
And it's very much a privilege, in my opinion, to hear a lot of these stories. And even in this context, you know, being able to hear your story of how you turned a crisis into something fairly powerful is really what we want to drill into today. And I think it's particularly timely that we hit in this particular part. I was wondering if you could share a little bit, Dave, with, I guess, the context around the particular crisis within your organization that you had to work around, and give whatever background details you think are important to our audience to really understand, and then we can kind of take it from there.
Sure. Back in October of 2018, my agency first is in Pittsburgh, but back in October 2018, some people might recall that there was a shooting at a synagogue here on a Saturday morning, while people were starting to gather for worship in the synagogue. And of the people who were killed in that shooting, and it was far too many people were killed, it was very sad, two of the men that were killed were brothers that my agency supported. Cecil and David Rosenthal, and they, you know, they volunteered heavily at the church or at the synagogue. They were two brothers that I knew. They were in our vocational supports as well as our residential supports. And by chance, you know, being Pittsburgh and being a small, big city, you know, I actually knew them back from my high school days. I grew up in the same neighborhood, basically, that they lived in. And they were a little bit older than me, but not that much. But in high school, when I used to ride the school bus, at some point the city schools decided it was easier to give the high school students bus passes for the public transportation than it was to coordinate yellow school buses. Since I was going to a school that was not my normal school, I went to a magnet school. So I was going to a school outside of my neighborhood. And so I actually would ride the bus in, and I remember very specifically Cecil and David, and just brief conversations you would have just like you would with anybody else riding a public bus. But I used to see him enough because I rode the same bus for basically 4 years that I remember him very well from that. And, you know, skip ahead to 2005 and there's Cecil and David I get to see again all of a sudden. I remember them very well from it. I don't think they remember me very well, but just basic interactions from seeing them in the bus or in the neighborhood. Yeah, they were a special group of brothers. Yes, they had intellectual disabilities, but it wasn't a big deal. I grew up around people with disabilities, and so to me, that wasn't an issue. And obviously, working in a disability field, that's not an issue. But just getting to know them even more so as an adult. And Cecil, I got to see more often because he used to come by your main office to pick up mail to take back to one of our sites. So he used to lag around a little bit before he went back to the bus so he could just, you know, shoot the breeze with folks. And, you know, he always liked chatting with me about different things. And at one point, you know, I got invited to go to some meals with him. I got invited to go worship with him. So I've been to temple with him during the high holidays. And, you know, that to me was a very important, you know, faith and religion is a very important part of my life and why I basically got into fundraising because of the Sunday school connection, which I talked about earlier. And just, you know, just he was just wanting somebody to come worship with him, I thought was pretty powerful. That he's willing to share that experience, and it meant a lot to me. So that always stuck with me. But yeah, they were both killed, unfortunately, in the shooting. They were two great guys that were very active in the community, more so than somebody that you might consider with a disability when you think about somebody with a disability. Everybody knew them. You know, they walked all around. Cecil liked to walk around and ask for food from the different restaurants all the time. And he got friendly with everybody, and everybody was friends with him and David as well. Yeah, and they were just a great couple of brothers. And it was pretty awful hearing about it when we were the shooting occurred. Obviously. Many of us knew that that's when they announced there was a shooting at a synagogue and they announced the name of the synagogue. Many of us at work knew that's where they attended. And they were there every Saturday reading. They were typically greeters and they would hand out, you know, songbooks or different things as you came in or different pamphlets. And, you know, obviously the news wasn't releasing names or anything for a bit. And we waited longer and we didn't hear anything. And by chance, that same day was also our agency's employee recognition dinner, where we actually celebrated service anniversaries for people working 5 or 10 or 15 years. So there was a large gathering of staff. We're a pretty big organization with full-time and part-time staff. We probably have over 1,000 people right now on staff. So there's a lot of people. And of this group, there might have been 300 or so together. And that's where we heard that kind of confirmation that they indeed had passed away as a result. And it was very difficult, but at the same time, I was very glad we were together to hear that and not all separate so we could talk a little bit to each other and try to work through the surprise and shock, I guess, that there was. But starting the very next morning, as names were starting to be released, that we started getting donations online through our website in memory of Cecil and David. And we started getting media requests through our website, through emails, through phone calls. And this is something that we didn't put out there, but people started somebody picked up that they were supported by Achieva. We knew the family very well, their sisters and their family very well. And we actually worked with them on stuff, and we still continue to do so. But because of different things, we all of a sudden started getting a large influx of donations from all over the globe. So we ended up getting donations from four countries, and about 1,000 donors from, you know, around the US and Canada and Europe and Israel. And, you know, just all of a sudden I had to learn how to make sure I'm sending not just donor recognition letters and thank you letters to people in the States, but also to countries that aren't my own. That I, you know, I knew a bit about it, but I didn't have donors for the past 15 years or so, since I've, or 13 years at the time, at Achieva that were from foreign countries. So we had to update a lot of information. We suddenly had to make sure we were receiving things correctly, and making sure things were sent out in the proper format, and not just a simple thank you email or thank you letter. And at the same time, trying to field work with my department. You know, we work obviously hand in hand with our communication staff, and just making sure that we were communicating with all the different media outlets and trying to handle that. I know the family at one point got very overwhelmed just because of the volume and their own grief. And that, you know, you have families, of course, need time to grieve, just like staff members or friends or any loved one that you have that passes away. So we also helped the family field media calls and media inquiries, whether it was from print media or TV or radio or internet-based media, and it came from across the globe just as well. And yeah, it was, you know, the interest and curiosity people had about, you know, how Dave and Cecil lived their lives and how active they were in the community, but people really just wanted to know more about who they were and what made them so special. So we were fortunate enough to be able to share that with others. But at the same time, again, it made it very difficult for our communication staff because there was so much coming in all of a sudden. The same way the fundraising staff all of a sudden had to, you know, acknowledge and thank 1,000 new donations that ended up coming in.
And that's all quite a bit to put it very mildly. So thank you for sharing that, Dave. And I mm-hmm. think as we pick apart some of these pieces, there'll be more that comes of this particular conversation. But wanted mm-hmm. to ask, as someone who had a personal connection to David and Cecil, were there times where you found yourself either doing things differently or changing how you might approach things normally because you had that personal connection and you felt more motivated in certain cases? I guess give us a bit of headspace around the personal connection and its relation to some of your work.
Yeah, one of the things that I've been doing, because I did know Cecil and David for such a long period of my life, I mean, it wasn't a big part early on, but it was the past 13 years or so, that just getting to know them a little bit better and making sure others knew who they were. One of the things that my organization did that came out of this was we did a project called Love Like the Boys. And it's something my communication staff came up with, which I'm very thankful for, because Love Like the Boys was a way to try to find something good in something bad. And that's part of the reason why people donate when something bad happens. They don't know what else to do, but they want to help. And this was an opportunity for people to help, and it didn't necessarily cost anything to do it. It's doing random acts of kindness and doing it in such a way that's in memory of Cecil and David. So we actually created a Facebook page that people could learn a little bit more about Cecil and David, but also post the things they were doing in memory of them, good acts. Because we've had, you know, a number of people donated things. People sent flowers. People sent food. You know, actually a group of students at Duquesne University painted rocks. And they actually had positive messages on them, and they placed them all around our building, like a little barrier, if you will, to help, you know, like a big hug, if you will. And that was pretty powerful as well. But just sharing things like that. So we've had people that, you know, started finding this Love Like the Boys page, and it quickly outgrew the number of people liked our own Facebook page, and it wasn't something we heavily promoted. But the family was involved and they loved the idea of doing things in memory of Cecil and David that were good things. So it was from things like buying the coffee for the person behind you in line at the coffee shop, to putting quarters next to gumball machines so that kids could get free gum, to buying a meal, or to doing volunteer projects in memory of Cecil David, or, you know, we've had people from all across the globe do things now. So six continents, we've had volunteer projects, or random acts of kindness, memory of Cecil David. And there's actually a little card that we created that people can leave behind, so that people can go to our Facebook page, and it's just Love Like the Boys on Facebook. And you can see all the different things that people are doing, and people regularly post positive things that are going on in the community, all the good things people are doing. And that's actually one of the things how it fits in the, it was great with what we're doing there, but it fits into what's going on now with all of the coronavirus issues that everybody's dealing with right now. Because we can't do a lot, but there are a lot of great stories that are happening, whether it's people making masks at home, or making meals for their neighbors, or, you know, things like that, that you can share. And there's a lot of, you know, it might be a bad time, and you might be feeling down, but there's a lot of good that's still happening, and you need to remember that. And it's a way to teach others a little bit about what's, who this is and why you're doing it. So in this case, people were, you know, teaching you about Cecil and David and all the great things that they did, and why they were so active in the community. And now you can do it in their name and still help. So we saw people doing it all the time, and it's, you know, it continues to grow. The page on Facebook continues to grow. And again, it wasn't about promoting our organization. We were very careful about that. We don't want to promote necessarily Achieva, and it wasn't about Achieva. It was about Cecil and David and trying to remember them. And all along the way, we had permission from the family to do so, because the last thing we wanted to do, which is something very careful you have to be with right now, is you never want to try to exploit someone or feel like you're exploiting them for your own benefit. And that's the last thing we were trying to do.
Mm-hmm. And for you guys, were there, aside from coordinating very closely with the family and using a bit of your ethical decision-making lens, were there particular pieces that you implemented or processes you implemented or a process you developed that maintain that appropriate balance of honoring someone's legacy, funneling that positivity that people wanted to do into something that you were able to actually help with?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that we did is, you know, we did get a lot of money donated very quickly, and we weren't sure what we were going to do with it or what we needed to do with it. I mean, it just came in memory of Cecil and David. Very little of it was restricted to any specific project or program that we offer. And so in working with the family and meeting with them and making sure it was okay, one of the things we did was create an award in memory of Cecil and David. We do an annual awards event where we honor volunteers or people to do good things for people with disabilities. And so we created an award in memory of Cecil and David for somebody who has a disability, but they're doing something very active in the community the same way Cecil and David were, and trying to make the community more inclusive. And so we created that, and that person gets a stipend, a small stipend as an award each year. Each year we offer it. But then at the same time, we also created the Cecil and David Rosenthal Memorial Fund with the family. And the idea is that this pool of money, which has now grown to over $200,000, that we would award grants, not necessarily big grants, but grants for individuals with disabilities that, whether that we support or they're mostly, they need to be in our service area, but they're doing things that are much more, to be much more included in the community. And so again, that was a matter of working with the family to make sure that's okay. And Cecil and David's sisters actually come to the awards event when we do the awards, and they come and they give us our blessing on who's chosen for the award, but also they give us the blessing for the grants that we give out of this fund. And one of the things we want to do is, in addition to making these grants, we want to make sure that we're able to continue to offer these grants after we've given some out. So it's not just a matter of, we're not using just the interest, we're using some of the principal. But we want to be able to offer grants for a long time and still be able to remember Cecil and David for a long time to come. And so we are continuing to raise a little bit of money for it in different ways. One of the things we were going to do that got postponed because of the virus issue was, we have a big black tie dinner where we have a fund and mission moment during the dinner, and we typically get somebody to create a matching gift, and that matching gift would be, and the funds raised from that moment would go towards the fund. So this event had to get postponed until the fall. So, you know, that just delays right now what's happening. But things like that, we need to get approval from the family so that we're able to do it without exploiting Cecil and David. And again, it's not about, this is, you know, like any one of us, you know, we want to make sure that we're careful in how we go about it, but we want to continue to keep them in our memory.
I'm wondering, Dave, if you could give us a bit of a rundown of some of the final numbers post, not necessarily a campaign, but post that period of people looking to do good in David and Cecil's memory.
Sure. The page, I believe, is about 4,000 or a little bit less than 4,000 people that like it and follow it on Facebook. It's people post daily to it, things that are going on, whether it's an organization that needs help, or it's, you know, you overheard somebody in line having a bad day and you have one of the cards. Like, I carry around a card in my wallet usually in case something comes up, but you know, you overhear somebody having a bad day and you give them a little note and a little, like maybe a gift card or something. This is what somebody did, and write a little uplifting note that, you know, things are going to get better. It's okay. You know, just little things like that we see often, and, you know, people love it and they take the ideas, and sometimes they take it and do it themselves. Or sometimes they just take it and share it. We've had classrooms of students do volunteer projects in memory of Cecil and David, and the teacher will post a picture of something that they've created for it. I know there's, for instance, a room in Israel that was created for, it's a recreational activity room for soldiers on leave that was named in memory of Cecil and David. You know, there's lots of things all over the globe. I know people have put stuff in the Trevely Fountain in Italy, and, you know, in Asia, people, you know, bought stuff for people, or South America, they did the same thing. And it's, you know, just even the smallest thing can make the biggest impact. And we just don't know it right now, but, you know, that impact and that ripple effect makes a big deal further along. And it's a great place to go when you're feeling bad, because you see all the good in the world.
Without a doubt, it really restores your faith in humanity that it's not about, you know, when things get bad, we don't divide and scatter, but we come together and we conquer as a collective group in the most altruistic of senses, not in we're going to go conquer a city somewhere or something like that. Wondering, Dave, you talked about these types of random acts of kindness being able to create a bit of a ripple effect across countries, across borders, across communities. Within your own organization, did this crisis cause any ripple effects that have changed how you go about and you and the rest of your team and organization go about and do the work that you do, whether it's on the programmatic side or the fundraising side or the comm side, that you might be able to share with some of our listeners?
Yeah, definitely in the fundraising communication side, things changed a little bit for us. And at least from my point of view, I'm a little more deliberate in some of the things that we do. We've been trying to be donor-centric, like, you know, a lot of people are trying to be in their own organizations, but I go out of my way to try to remember that and remember the point of view of the materials that we're doing are supposed to be coming from the individual, and we're supposed to highlight the individual and the donations that are doing good. And it's not about the fact that Achieva has a new program or Achieva's program has grown. It's, oh, there's a person is supporting us, and because of that support, more people with disabilities can, you know, have more employment skills, or they have a better home, or they have advocacy, those sorts of things. And it's reminding myself to take myself out of the equation. Yes, I'm there, but I'm not really the reason why these things are happening. I'm just connecting everything. Fundraising's not necessarily about me, but it's helping the donor connect with what they want to donate to. It's helping the joyful act of giving. And, you know, we're providing people with the skills to do that. So our communications, we do a lot more communications, and we more so not just, hey, we've been had communications ongoing since this happened with what we're doing with the funds or what we're doing as an organization, so that the donors know that the fund, you know, it wasn't just you donate it, you never hear from us again, but it's you donated, and oh, by the way, you're going to still hear from us for a while, because there's so many good things still going on based on the donations that were made. So we have a lot more communications, and we focus on that, trying to tell more stories, even more so than we have in the past. So for me, there's been a change from that standpoint.
And are there any particular pieces that you have found have, in terms of some of those changes or those adaptations, that you were making in fairly live time as all of these mm-hmm. donations, all of these requests were coming in. Are there elements of what you and your team implemented and perhaps some specific examples or one or two specific cases of this where what you adapted in that moment has stuck for your organization? You mentioned things like storytelling and more obviously donor centricity in your communications. Are there specific examples either within that or even one or even examples that have stuck to this day that you could speak to some detail?
Mm-hmm. Sure. There's been a number of things that have stuck. And especially going on right now, one of it is we've been communicating a lot more than we probably would have in the past. Even during this time with coronavirus stuff going on, some people are at home, whether it's people we support or at home more or the families, but they're there. They want to hear from us. They want to know what's going on. We don't want to overwhelm them with information, but at the same time, we want to provide them with information that's important to them, not necessarily information important to us. So we're giving them information we have. We set up a webpage with activities that people can do while they're at home. Because whether it's families or kids or people we're supporting, and there's all age groups, there are activities on there. But we're trying to create resources for others so that we can help. And it's not necessarily, you're not providing you with vocational employment supports right now. But at the same time, you can get new activities that you didn't know you would have liked to do while you're home doing nothing because you have to stay home for a bit. We continue to do videos, which we've increased a lot in the past probably 2.5 years. The number of videos we do, and this started a little bit before the major incident here with the synagogue, but it really ramped up after it. And working with different groups to help promote it. We have one in particular we've been working on that I'm happy to share that one of our board members who had a sibling with disabilities that we supported, and she after her sister passed away, she joined our board as a volunteer and then started making gifts. And so we have one of our staff members in our communications department who happens to have a disability, and that's not why we hired her, but she's a great communicator, and we do videos that she interviews people. So we decided to do one on understanding why people support Achieva, why it's still important to talk, the programs are still important even in this time, why people get involved as volunteers, what are things to remember, what are resources available to family members. And it's just simple things like that that we sometimes take for granted because we assume families know them or understand it, but they might not. And it takes a lot of repetition sometimes too, especially in communications, before people actually catch it or actually take action. Even with your call to action, it takes repetition sometimes to get to that point of doing that action. So we've been doing a lot more with that. And we have done a little bit with fundraising. And again, we're not trying to go out and emergency fundraise because we're not financially in an emergency position. But we do want to encourage people to give still for the different supports that we have that are still ongoing.
And then out of bringing our conversation from the situation, the crisis that occurred with David and Cecil to today, are there particular lessons or particular tactics, strategies, things of that nature that have helped you in terms of some of your work and also share and also some perhaps lessons that other people can learn from that are particularly timely in this particular crisis, I would say?
Yeah, a couple of things that I would say translate directly with what's going on right now with what happened to us. First, be transparent about what's going on. Communicate a lot. It doesn't have to be a big email or a very lengthy video recording. Just information. People want to hear your voice. They want to know things are still kind of normal. And they just want to hear new news. And it's not necessarily news about, what's going on with the virus. It's just news that, hey, we're still here. We're doing work, basic stuff like that, and how we're handling it and how we're still moving forward, because we know we're going to move forward. Because people with disabilities still need supports that we offer, and that's not going to go away. And so people want to understand that we're here and we're not going away. But at the same time, again, also the third thing is the key thing, I think, is finding something good and something bad. So it's very easy if you watch too much news or spend too much time. As much as I love social media, you have to take a time off away from it for a little bit, because there is doom and gloom, but there's also good things going on at the same time. And so don't be afraid to highlight some of the good things going on and not to, reduce the importance of what's going on with the virus and everything within everybody's own communities. But you need to make sure that, you're looking at some of the good that's in the community. Every community has it. It's just a matter of pointing it out. And so we're trying to do that as well. So we have a newsletter an electronic newsletter, I've been going out every other week. But what we're doing now, we were sending out information every other week with some information about stuff with the virus, but also our programs. But the alternate week now, we're also going to highlight some positive stories and good things, not to bring levity, but actually just to, make sure people understand there's still good going on.
And then with that good piece, that doing good piece, is it a combination of stories that some of your community and donors and stakeholders are submitting to you, or are they ones that you have found are happening kind of organically within the community, or are they ones that are directly benefiting your organization? Is there a certain mix, yeah, I guess, that people are? Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a mix. I mean, there's some that are benefiting us, whether it's somebody's making cotton face masks for our organization as a volunteer and they're refusing to accept payment for it, or it's, working with, volunteer projects that some of the folks we're supporting are doing in their own homes, to just simple things that people are doing in the community. And it doesn't necessarily mean that they're supporting us or our own organization, but they're just doing good in the community. We want to highlight that, so that, people remember that there is that good going on still.
And you pointed to a few lessons that you hope that organizations, I guess, implement and take from this particular crisis and crises in general, around things like being transparent, of almost over communicating, of finding something good and something bad. Do you think any of those particular, I guess, modifications, pivots, changes, or any of the ones that we've talked about in our conversation so far are here to stay when it comes to fundraising and donor comms and other activities that fundraising advancement teams might be doing?
Yeah, I do think there are, because staff will now be used to doing it more often, and it's going to be front of mind. But at the same time, it's always been a best practice. It's just people haven't done it, or they haven't put the effort into it. And now that they realize they do have time to be able to do these things, where in the past they had time, they just didn't realize it or didn't prioritize it. And that's important. And I think that's what's going to help us move forward. And it's going to be something, hopefully, that does stick, because it is something that's very beneficial, not just to your organization, but really the person on the other end, the volunteer, the donor, the trustee, the constituent, community member, whoever it is. They really do want to hear what's going on, and they value you and they want to be valued at the same time. So that's, communication's a huge way to do that. And, connecting with them fundraising wise as well is a huge thing too.
And in terms of some of the processes that your team has had to adopt, now that I imagine a lot of the work that you're doing is either virtual or part staff are in the office and part staff are working remotely, mainly on the comms fundraising side of things, are there certain, I guess, new procedures or protocols you've adopted that you think are here to stay, exclusively for your organization, or that you think that the rest of the sector might benefit from adopting, whether it's through just doing a lot more Zoom meetings or waiting whether or not, meeting in person is required, or being more relaxed around things like working from home, things of that nature?
Mm-hmm. I think some of it that will help is, one, staff can do some stuff virtually. I know not every organization does that. Some do that, not everyone. But we can now see that we can do very simple things away from the office. And it's nice to get in and meet. And that's actually one of the things I think is also going to change, is that we're going to have more meetings internally. When you're looking at internal organization, whether it's your exec team's going to meet more often or your own staff department's going to meet more often. Again, it's good business management to try to have meetings. But when things are changing so rapidly, if you can have a meeting daily, like some of mine have turned into daily meetings, that's great, because I know what's going on more often. And it's not just seeing somebody passing in the hallway, or, if a donor relations specialist is out meeting with a donor, or a fundraiser is out meeting with a donor, they're not necessarily in the office all the time, but it's a way to connect back more. So everybody knows what's going on. And so I think that that will definitely impact what the new normal, if you will, what we will be doing.
And with that meetings piece, I'm hearing some of our listeners just like cringing at the thought of more internal meetings. And I know for some people it's death by internal meeting. I wonder if you could speak to, how do you make sure that those meetings continue to, if we're going to have, if you have, you know, speculations that we might have more internal meetings because we're starting to see the value, how do you keep those meetings, I guess, relevant and valuable to have, and not just to, oh my goodness, we're having another meeting today. Like this just, it just seems like an extra, you know, log on the fire that's not doing a whole bunch.
Right. Yeah, no, it's the meetings, you know, you want to try to keep them shorter, but you, whoever is kind of leading the meeting, and it doesn't have to be the same person every time, but it's, you know, they have an agenda that you stick to. You don't, you know, shoot the breeze too much. It's very easy to sit there and chat for a bit. I saw one stat that virtual meetings, almost two or about a third of it, if not more, is actually people fumbling with the technology. And then they just chat about the weather for a little bit and that sort of stuff. And then, you know, the rest of it is about meetings. So you, so a half hour meeting, you lose 10 to 12 minutes of that meeting just getting ready to start. So you have like a 20 minute meeting. But just, you know, people are now also more comfortable with the tools. As somebody who also teaches in a graduate IT program, getting people more comfortable with technology has been great. You know, we see people stumble through it sometimes, but that's how you learn. That's how I like to learn anyway. You know, the more mistakes you make, the better you're going to get because you learn from your mistakes. And you're just doing it internally, so it's not an external issue, hopefully, with doing it. But yeah, you get better use of technology and the resources that have always been there. It's just people haven't utilized them. And whether it's free tools or stuff your organization already subscribes to, it's out there. And, you know, it's easy to use. It's just got to get people to use it.
Mm-hmm. And as someone with a significant level of expertise on more of the IT side of things and being able to teach people those, whether they are the free tools, whether they're the paid tools, are there ones that you found with your team or even teams in the past that have paid significant dividends in terms of investing in, whether it's learning a certain software or being able to use a certain web tool, whatever that might be, that you can give as suggestions or advice to those listening?
Yeah, obviously using a tool, whether it's Zoom, like what we're using now to record this, or other meeting tools, whether it's GoToMeeting or WebEx or Google Hangout meetings, you know, whatever works best for you is great. There's no one tool that helps every single organization the same way. Everybody has different needs, so find the one that's right for you, but there's a lot of great options, especially when you're doing meetings. Some of the things that also we found to be very helpful is a tool we invested in a little while ago in the past 2 years that we can produce little short videos that we send out to donors. And it doesn't necessarily have to be to donors. It can just be to anybody. So we sent out some brief videos that we recorded telling some of our donors and VIPs and trustees and key volunteers that, hey, we're thinking about you. We hope you're okay. We can send those to people we have emails for, but even for the people we don't, it's just a matter of using your phone and remembering this technology is there. You should use it. Just call people. There, you know, a lot of people are home right now, more so than before, and they're looking for human interaction. As much as I love doing some work from home, and I have teenage kids, you know, I like adult talk too. It's not just talking about schoolwork or, you know, what's going on in TikTok, because that's what my kids are up to right now, which is a different tool, which, you know, you might like as well for your organization. That's a whole different podcast, I think. But yeah, there's lots of great little tools that you can use. And those are just a couple that we found to be helpful.
I guess as a final question to start to wrap down a bit of this conversation around, you know, what's the current reality with fundraising around COVID-19? What are things that people can embrace to kind of move forward from this? And what is kind of onward look like from this? From a communication standpoint, more so like back and forth communication between your donors, your supporters, things like that. Are there certain best practices? Are there things that you've chosen to amp up on, whether it is those short videos to maintain not just kind of a one-way conversation with your supporters and donors, but also more of like a two-way to even inform some of the things that you might choose to bring on or adopt?
Yeah, it's definitely two-way. You need to remember all communication's two-way. There are different tools like CauseVid is what we use. Allows us, we can do our own recordings and send them out, but we can also ask our constituents to do recordings and send them back to us that we can use, which is a great resource. Just having that open communication has really been key. And I think it's been a key part of stewardship and donor stewardship and specifically. You don't need to talk to people, just asking them every time you talk to them. You can talk and communicate a lot without having to ask for anything. It's just an opportunity to have a conversation and just check how they're doing. A lot of people just want to talk and, tell you, how they're doing and what they're up to. And they're glad to hear what you're up to as well. And hopefully you've built a relationship as a fundraiser. You're building relationships with your donors that you can talk. And if somebody's sick, you know about it and you hope they feel better. And just catch up on different people and what they're up to, because we do build personal relationships with donors that we work with. And this is, a time just to continue to build and continue to steward people and let them know what you're doing.
I also think a positive unintended consequence of you sending additional communications to your donors, even just to let them know what you're doing, is with this new volume of emails and other messages people are getting, those people who truly don't deserve to be in your database or on your mailing list choose to take a step back and say, you know what, maybe this wasn't quite for me, but it allows you to weed out who aren't the true believers, which I think is one of those like positive unintended consequences, that good and the bad, if you would, but even though that the sending out emails is quite positive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I agree.
Mm-hmm. So Dave, thank you so much for taking the time today. Wanted to ask you, are there any things that you're working on right now that people can contribute to our listeners, or anything that you're working on that folks can keep their eyes open for?
Well, I would highly recommend, again, I talked about it before, but Love Like the Boys on Facebook. Just look for the group. You're welcome to join. Anybody's welcome to join. It's not about my organization. It's about the volunteer and random acts of kindness stuff that people do. Look for that. And in the organization as well, we're doing quite a bit more, but I've been sharing this story about Cecil Leavitt for a bit. And it's, very important that, they get remembered for good and not just remembered for something bad that happened. And they were two special guys, and I'm happy I'm able to share their story with others. And I've been lucky enough to be able to go to different places virtually and in person to talk about it. But I'll keep talking about it until I get, people stop asking.
I think it's safe to say, Dave, that people will not be stopping asking you to speak about Cecil and David, as well as mm-hmm. so many other topics within the charitable sector. And I think our listeners are going to be very benefited by the amount of knowledge that you've disseminated onto them. So we're really grateful for you spending the time, especially given the current circumstances and how busy and in demand yourself as well as the rest of the sector is. So we're truly grateful for you spending the time with us.
Well, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Hey, everyone. Christian here with a few short things before you take off. A big thanks for tuning into another episode of Beyond the Bake Sale. Did you love the episode? Then we'd be grateful for a rating on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or Spotify. Don't want to miss our next episode? Then make sure you hit that subscribe button. Want to collaborate on something? Have a story that you want to tell? Have feedback for us? Then shoot us a message by heading to our website at www.btbs.ca. While you're there, you can follow us on social, read our blog, and also listen to past episodes. But above all, thank you for committing to moving beyond the bake sale.